He came over to her and tugged at the hem of her dress like a little boy. She looked down. He stood on tiptoe and kissed her cheek. "I love you, Ma." She looked startled, not at the kiss, but either at what he had said or the tone in which he had said it. "Why, I know that, Larry," she said. "About what you said. About being in trouble. I am a little, but it's not..." Her voice was cold and stern at once, so cold, in fact, that it frightened him a little. "I don't want to hear about that." "Okay," he said. "Listen, Ma, what's the best theater around here?" "The Lux Twin," she said, "but I don't know what's playing there." "It doesn't matter. You know what I think? There's three things you can get every place in America, but you can only get them good in New York City." "Yeah, Mr. New York Times critic, what are those?" "Movies, baseball, and hot dogs from Needick's." She laughed. "You ain't stupid, Larry. You never were." So he went down to the men's room and washed the blood off his forehead and went back and kissed his mother again and got $15 from her scuffed black purse and went to the movies at the Lux and watched an insane, malignant revenant named Freddy Krueger suck a number of teenagers into the quicksand of their own dreams, where all but one of them, the heroine, died. Freddy Krueger also appeared to die at the end, but it was hard to tell, and since this movie had a Roman numeral after its name and seemed to be well attended, Larry thought the man with the razors on the tips of his fingers would be back, without knowing that the persistent sound in the row behind him signaled the end to all that. There would be no more sequels, and in a very short time, there would be no more movies at all. In the row behind Larry, a man was coughing. Chapter 12. There was a grandfather clock standing in the far corner of the parlor. Franny Goldsmith had been listening to its measured ticks and tocks all of her life. It summed up the room, which she had never liked and, on days like today, actively hated. Her favorite room in the place was her father's workshop. It was in the shed that connected house and barn. You got there through a small door which was barely 5 feet high and nearly hidden behind the old kitchen wood stove. The door was good to begin with. Small and almost hidden, it was deliciously like the sort of door one encountered in fairy tales and fantasies. When she grew older and taller, she had to duck through it just as her father did. Her mother never went out into the workshop unless she absolutely had to. It was an Alice in Wonderland door, and for a while her pretend game, secret even from her father, was that one day when she opened it, she would not find Peter Goldsmith's workshop at all. Instead, she would find an underground passageway leading somehow from Wonderland to Hobbiton, a low but somehow cozy tunnel with rounded earthen sides and an earthen ceiling interlaced with sturdy roots that would give your head a good bump if you knocked it against any of them. A tunnel that smelled not of wet soil and damp and nasty bugs and worms, but one which smelled of cinnamon and baking apple pies, one which ended somewhere up ahead in the pantry of Bag End, where Mr. Bilbo Baggins was celebrating his 71st birthday party. Well, that cozy tunnel never turned out to be there. But to the Franny Goldsmith who had grown up in this house, the workshop, sometimes called the tool shop by her father and that dirty place where your dad goes to drink beer by her mother, had been enough. Strange tools and odd gadgets. A huge chest with 1,000 drawers, each of the 1,000 crammed full. Nails, screws, bits, sandpaper. Of three kinds, rough, rougher, and roughest. Planes, levels, and all the other things she'd had no name for then and still had no name for. It was dark in the workshop, except for the cobwebby 40-watt bulb that hung down by its cord and the bright circle of light from the tensor lamp that was always focused where her father was working. There were the smells of dust and oil and pipe smoke, and it seemed to her now that there should be a rule. Every father must smoke. Pipe, cigar, cigarette, marijuana, hash, lettuce leaves, something. Because the smell of smoke seemed an integral part of her own childhood. "Hand me that French, Franny." "No, the little one." "What did you do at school today?" "She did." "Well, why would Ruthie Sears want to push you down?" "Yes, it is nasty, very nasty scrape. But it goes good with the color of your dress, don't you think?" Now, if you could only find Ruthie Sears and get her to push you down again and scrape the other leg, then you'd have a pair. Hand me that big screwdriver, would you? No, the one with the yellow handle. Franny Goldsmith, you come out of that nasty place right now and change your school clothes. Right now, you'll be filthy. Even now, at 21, she could duck through that doorway and stand between his work table and the old Ben Franklin stove that gave out such stuporous heat in the winter time, and catch some of what it had felt like to be such a small Franny Goldsmith growing up in this house. It was an illusory feeling, almost always intermingled with sadness for her barely remembered brother Fred, whose own growing up had been so rudely and finally interrupted. She could stand and smell the oil that was rubbed into everything, the must, the faint odor of her father's pipe. She could rarely remember what it had been like to be so small, so strangely small, but out there she sometimes could, and it was a glad way to feel. But the parlor now, the parlor. If the workshop was the goodness of childhood, symbolized by the phantom smell of her father's pipe, he sometimes puffed smoke gently into her ear when she had an earache, always after extracting a promise that she wouldn't tell Carla, who would have had a fit. Then the parlor was everything in childhood you wished you could forget. Speak when spoken to. Easier to break it than to fix it. Go right upstairs this minute and change your clothes. Don't you know that isn't suitable? Don't you ever think? Franny, don't pick at your clothes. People will think you have fleas. What must your Uncle Andrew and Aunt Carlene think? You embarrassed me half to death. The parlor was where you were tongue-tied. The parlor was where you itched and couldn't scratch. The parlor was dictatorial commands, boring conversation, relatives pinching cheeks, aches, sneezes that couldn't be sneezed, coughs that couldn't be coughed, and above all, yawns that must not be yawned. At the center of this room, where her mother's spirit dwelt, was the clock. It had been built in 1889 by Carla's grandfather, Tobias Downs, and it had ascended to family heirloom status almost immediately, shifting down through the years, carefully packed and insured for moves from one part of the country to another. It had originally come into being in the Buffalo, New York workshop of Tobias, a place which had undoubtedly been every bit as smoky and nasty as Peter's workshop, although such a comment would have struck Carla as completely irrelevant. Sometimes shifting from one section of the family to another when cancer, heart attack, or accident pinched off some branch of the family tree. The clock had been in this parlor since Peter and Carla Goldsmith moved into the house some 36 years ago. Here it had been placed, and here it had stayed, ticking and talking, marking off segments of time in a dry age. Some day the clock would be hers, if she wanted, Franny reflected as she looked into her mother's white, shocked face. But I don't want it. Don't want it and won't have it. In this room there were dried flowers under glass bells. There was in this room a dove-gray carpet with dusky pink roses figured into the nap. There was a graceful bow window that looked down the hill to Route 1, with a big privet hedge between the road and the grounds. Carla had nagged her husband with a grim fervor until he planted that hedge right after the Exxon station on the corner went up. Once it was in, she nagged her husband to make it grow faster. Even radioactive fertilizer, Franny thought, would have been acceptable to her if it had served that end. The stridency of her remonstrations concerning the privet had lessened as the hedge grew taller, and she supposed it would stop altogether in another 2 years or so, when the hedge finally grew tall enough to blot out the offending gas station completely, and the parlor was inviolate again. It would stop on that subject, at least. Stencils on the wallpaper, large green leaves and pink flowers almost the same shade as the roses in the carpet. Early American furniture and a dark mahogany set of double doors. A fireplace which was just for show, where a birch log sat eternally on a hearth of red brick which was eternally immaculate and untouched by even a speck of soot. Franny guessed that by now the log was so dry that it would burn like newspaper if lit. Above the log was a pot almost big enough for a child to bathe in. It had been handed down from Franny's great-grandmother, and it hung eternally suspended over the eternal log. Above the mantel, finishing that part of the picture, was the eternal flintlock rifle. Segments of time in a dry age. One of her earliest memories was of peeing on the dove gray rug with the dusky pink roses figured into the nap. She might have been 3, not trained for very long, and probably not allowed in the parlor save for special occasions because of the chance of accidents. But somehow she had gotten in, and seeing her mother not just running but sprinting to grab her up before the unthinkable could happen had brought the unthinkable on. Her bladder let go, and the spreading stain as the dove gray rug turned to a darker slate gray around her bottom had caused her mother to actually shriek. The stain had finally come out, but after how many patient shampooings? The Lord might know. Franny Goldsmith did not. It was in the parlor that her mother had talked to her, grimly, explicitly, and at length, after she caught Franny and Norman Burstein examining each other in the barn, their clothes piled in one amicable heap on a hay bale to one side. "How would she like it?" Carla asked as the grandfather clock solemnly ticked off segments of time in a dry age. "If she took Franny out for a walk up and down U.S. Route 1 without any clothes on, how would that be?" Franny, then 6, had cried, but had somehow managed to avoid the hysterics which impended at this prospect. When she was 10, she had ridden her bike into the mailbox post while looking back over her shoulder to yell something to Georgette McGuire. She cut her head, bloodied her nose, lacerated both knees, and had actually grayed out for a few moments with shock. When she came around, she had stumbled up the driveway to the house, weeping and horrified at the sight of so much blood coming out of herself. She would have gone to her father, but since her father was at work, she had stumbled into the parlor where her mother was serving tea to Mrs. Venner and Mrs. Prynne. "Get out!" her mother had screamed, and the next moment she was running to Franny, embracing her, crying, "Oh, Franny, oh dear, what happened? Oh, your poor nose!" But she was leading Franny back into the kitchen, where the floor could safely be bled upon, even as she was comforting her, and Franny never forgot that her first 2 words that day hadn't been, "Oh, Franny," but "Get out!" Her first concern had been for the parlor, where that dry age went on, and blood was not allowed. Perhaps Mrs. Prynne never forgot either, because even through her tears Franny had seen a shocked, slapped expression cross the woman's face. After that day, Mrs. Prynne had become something of a seldom caller. In her first year of junior high, she had gotten a bad conduct mark on her report card, and of course, she was invited into the parlor to discuss this mark with her mother. In her final year of senior high school, she had received 3 detention periods for passing notes, and that had likewise been discussed with her mother in the parlor. It was there that they discussed Franny's ambitions, which always ended up seeming a trifle shallow. It was there that they discussed Franny's hopes, which always ended up seeming a trifle unworthy. It was there that they discussed Franny's complaints, which always ended up seeming very much unwarranted, not to mention puling, whining, and ungrateful. It was in the parlor that her brother's coffin had stood on a trestle bedecked with roses, chrysanthemums, and lilies of the valley, their dry perfume filling the room while in the corner the poker-faced clock kept its place, ticking and talking off segments of time in a dry age. "You're pregnant," Carla Goldsmith repeated for the 2nd time. "Yes, Mother." Her voice was very dry, but she would not allow herself to wet her lips. She pressed them together instead. She thought, "In my father's workshop there is a little girl in a red dress, and she will always be there, laughing and hiding under the table with the vise clamped to one edge, or all bundled up with her scabby knees clasped against her chest behind the big toolbox with its 1,000 drawers. That girl is a very happy girl, but in my mother's parlor there is a much smaller girl who can't help piddling on the rug like a bad dog, like a bad little bitch puppy. And she will always be there, too, no matter how much I wish she would be gone." "Oh, Franny," her mother said, her words coming very quick. She laid a hand against the side of her cheek like an offended maiden aunt. "How did it happen?" It was Jesse's question. That was what really pissed her off. It was the same question he had asked. "Since you had 2 kids yourself, Mother, I think you know how it happened." "Don't be smart," Carla cried. Her eyes opened wide and flashed the hot fire that had always terrified Franny as a child. She was on her feet in the quick way she had, and that had also terrified her as a child. A tall woman with graying hair which was nicely upswept and tipped and generally beauty-shopped. A tall woman in a smart green dress and faultless beige hose. She went to the mantelpiece, where she always went in moments of distress. Resting there, below the flintlock, was a large scrapbook. Carla was something of an amateur genealogist, and her entire family was in that book, at least as far back as 1638, when its earliest traceable progenitor had risen out of the nameless crowd of Londoners long enough to be recorded in some very old church records as Merton Downs, Freemason. Her family tree had been published 4 years ago in the New England Genealogist, with Carla herself the compiler of record. Now she fingered that book of painstakingly amassed names, a safe ground where none could trespass. Were there no thieves in there any place? Franny wondered. No alcoholics? No unwed mothers? How could you do something like this to your father and me? She asked finally. Was it that boy Jesse?
It was Jesse. Jesse's the father.
Carla flinched at the word. How could you do it? Carla repeated. We did our best to bring you up in the right way. This is just... She put her hands to her face and began to weep.
How could you do it? She cried. After all we've done for you, this is the thanks we get? For you to go out and rut with a boy like a bitch in heat? You bad girl! You bad girl!
She dissolved into sobs, leaning against the mantelpiece for support, one hand over her eyes, the other continuing to slip back and forth over the green cloth cover of the scrapbook. Meantime, the grandfather clock went on ticking.
Mother, don't talk to me. You've said enough.
Franny stood up stiffly. Her legs felt like wood, but must not be, because they were trembling. Tears were beginning to leak out of her own eyes, but let them. She would not let this room defeat her again.
I'll be going now. You ate at our table, Carla cried at her suddenly. We loved you and supported you. And this is what we get for it. Bad girl! Bad girl!
Franny, blinded by tears, stumbled. Her right foot struck her left ankle. She lost her balance and fell down with her hands splayed out. She knocked the side of her head against the coffee table, and one hand sent a vase of flowers pitching onto the rug. It didn't break, but water gurgled out, turning dove gray to slate gray.
Look at that! Carla screamed, almost in triumph.
The tears had put black hollows under her eyes and cut courses through her makeup. She looked haggard and half mad.
Look at that! You spoiled the rug! Your grandmother's rug!
She sat on the floor, dazedly rubbing her head, still crying, wanting to tell her mother that it was only water, but she was completely unnerved now and not really sure. Was it only water? Or was it urine? Which? Again, moving with that spooky quickness, Carla Goldsmith snatched the vase up and brandished it at Franny.
What's your next move, miss? Are you planning to stay right here? Are you expecting us to feed you and board you while you sport yourself all around town? That's it, I suppose. Well, no. No. I won't have it. I will not have it.
I don't want to stay here, Franny muttered. Did you think I would?
Where are you going to go? With him?
I doubt it.
Bobby Rengarten in Dorchester, or Debbie Smith in Somersworth, I suppose.
Franny slowly gathered herself together and got up. She was still crying, but she was beginning to be mad as well. Not that it's any business of yours.
No business of mine, Carla echoed, still holding the vase.
Her face was parchment white.
No business of mine? What you do when you're under my roof is no business of mine? You ungrateful little bitch!
She slapped Franny, and slapped her hard. Franny's head rocked back. She stopped rubbing her head and started rubbing her cheek, looking unbelievingly at her mother.
This is the thanks we get for seeing you into a nice school, Carla said, showing her teeth in a merciless and frightful grin. Now you'll never finish. After you marry him, I'm not going to marry him, and I'm not going to quit school.
Carla's eyes widened. She stared at Franny as if Franny had lost her mind.
What are you talking about? An abortion? Having an abortion? You want to be a murderer as well as a tramp?
I'm going to have the child. I'll have to take the spring semester off, but I can finish next summer.
What do you think you're going to finish on? My money? If that's it, you've got a lot more thinking to do. A modern girl like you hardly needs support from her parents, does she?
Support I could use, Franny said softly. The money? Well, I'll get by.
There's not a bit of shame in you. Not a single thought for anyone but yourself, Carla shouted. My God, what this is going to do to your father and me. But you don't care a bit. It will break your father's heart, and
it don't feel so broken. Peter Goldsmith's calm voice came from the doorway, and they both swung around. In the doorway he was, but far back in it. The toes of his work boots stopped just short of the place where the parlor carpet took over from the shabbier one in the hallway. Franny realized suddenly that it was a place she had seen him in a great many times before. When had he last actually been in the parlor? She couldn't remember.
"What are you doing here?" Carla snapped, suddenly unmindful of any structural damage her husband's heart might have sustained. "I thought you were working late this afternoon."
"I switched off with Harry Masters," Peter said. "Fran's already told me, Carla. We are going to be grandparents."
"Grandparents!" she shrieked.
An ugly, confused sort of laughter jarred out of her.
"You leave this to me. She told you first, and you kept it from me. All right, it's what I've come to expect of you. But now I'm going to close the door, and the two of us are going to thrash this out."
She smiled with glittery bitterness at Franny.
"Just we girls."
She put her hand on the knob of the parlor door and began to swing it closed. Franny watched, still dazed, hardly able to comprehend her mother's sudden gush of fury and vitriol. Peter put his hand out slowly, reluctantly, and stopped the door halfway through its swing.
"Peter, I want you to leave this to me."
"I know you do. I have in the past. But not this time, Carla."
"This is not your province."
Calmly, he replied, "It is."
"Daddy..."
Carla turned on her, the parchment white of her face now tattooed red over the cheekbones.
"Don't you speak to him!" she screamed. "He's not the one you're dealing with. I know you could always wheedle him around to any crazy idea you had, or sweet-talk him into taking your side no matter what you did, but he is not the one you're dealing with today, miss."
"Stop it, Carla."
"Get out!"
"I'm not in. You can see the..."
"Don't you make fun of me! Get out of my parlor!"
And with that, she began to push the door, lowering her head and getting her shoulders into it until she looked like some strange bull, both human and female. He held her back easily at first, then with more effort. At last, the cords stood out on his neck, although she was a woman and 70 pounds lighter than he. Franny wanted to scream at them to stop it, to tell her father to go away so the two of them wouldn't have to look at Carla like this, at the sudden and irrational bitterness that had always seemed to threaten but which had now swept her up. But her mouth was frozen, its hinges seemingly rusted shut.
"Get out! Get out of my parlor! Out, out, out! You bastard! Let go of the goddamn door and get out!"
That was when he slapped her. It was a flat, almost unimportant sound. The grandfather clock did not fly into outraged dust at the sound, but went on ticking just as it had ever since it was set going. The furniture did not groan. But Carla's raging words were cut off as if amputated with a scalpel. She fell on her knees, and the door swung all the way open to bang softly against a high-backed Victorian chair with a hand-embroidered slipcover.
"No, oh no," Franny said in a hurt little voice.
Carla pressed a hand to her cheek and stared up at her husband. "You have had that coming for 10 years or better," Peter remarked. His voice had a slight unsteadiness in it. "I always told myself I didn't do it because I don't hold with hitting women. I still don't. But when a person, man or woman, turns into a dog and begins to bite, someone has to shy it off. I only wish, Carla, I'd had the guts to do it sooner. 'Twould have hurt us both less."
"Daddy..."
"Hush, Franny," he said with absent sternness, and she hushed. "You say she's being selfish," Peter said, still looking down into his wife's still shocked face. "You're the one doing that. You stopped caring about Franny when Fred died. That was when you decided caring hurt too much, and decided it'd be safer just to live for yourself. And this is where you came to do that, time and time and time again. This room. You doted on your dead family and forgot the part of it still living. And when she came in here and told you she was in trouble, asked for your help, I bet the first thing that crossed your mind was to wonder what the ladies in the Flower and Garden Club would say, or if it meant you'd have to stay away from Amy Lauder's wedding. Hurt's a reason to change, but all the hurt in the world don't change facts. You have been selfish. He reached down and helped her up. She came to her feet like a sleepwalker. Her expression didn't change. Her eyes were still wide and unbelieving. Relentlessness hadn't yet come back into them, but Franny dully thought that in time it would. It would. It's my fault for letting you go on, for not wanting any unpleasantness, for not wanting to rock the boat. I was selfish too, you see. And when Fran went off to school, I thought, well, now Carla can have what she wants, and it won't hurt nobody but herself. And if a person doesn't know they're hurting, why, maybe they're not. I was wrong. I've been wrong before, but never as bad as this. Gently, but with great force, he reached out and grasped Carla's shoulders. Now, I am telling you this as your husband. If Franny needs a place to stay, this can be the place, same as it always was. If she needs money, she can have it from my purse, same as she always could. And if she decides to keep her baby, you will see that she has a proper baby shower. And you may think no one will come, but she has friends, good ones, and they will. I'll tell you one more thing, too. If she wants it christened, it'll be done right here. Right here in this goddamned parlor. Carla's mouth had dropped open, and now a sound began to come from it. At first it sounded uncannily like the whistle of a tea kettle on a hot burner. Then it became a keening wail.
"Peter, your own son lay in his coffin in this room."
"Yes, and that's why I can't think of a better place to christen a new life," he said. "Fred's blood, live blood. Fred himself, he's been dead a lot of years, Carla. He was worm food long since." She screamed at that and put her hands to her ears. He bent down and pulled them away. "But the worms haven't got your daughter and your daughter's baby. It don't matter how it was got, it's alive. You act like you want to drive her off, Carla. What will you have if you do? Nothing but this room and a husband who'll hate you for what you did. If you do that, why, it might just as well have been all three of us that day. Me and Franny as well as Fred."
"I want to go upstairs and lie down," Carla said. "I feel nauseated. I think I'd better lie down."
"I'll help you," Franny said. "Don't you touch me. Stay with your father. You and he seem to have this all worked out, how you are going to destroy me in this town. Why don't you just settle into my parlor, Franny? Throw mud on the carpet, take ashes from the stove, and throw them into my clock.
Why not? Why not?"
She began to laugh and pushed past Peter into the hall. She was listing like a drunken woman. Peter tried to put an arm around her shoulders. She bared her teeth and hissed at him like a cat. Her laughter turned to sobs as she went slowly up the stairs, leaning on the mahogany banister for support. Those sobs had a ripping, helpless quality that made Franny want to scream and throw up at the same time. Her father's face was the color of dirty linen. At the top, Carla turned and swayed so alarmingly that for a moment Franny believed she would tumble all the way back down to the bottom. She looked at them, seemingly about to speak, then turned away again. A moment later, the closing of her bedroom door muted the stormy sound of her grief and hurt. Franny and Peter stared at each other, appalled, and the grandfather clock ticked calmly on. "This will work itself out," Peter said calmly. "She'll come around."
"Will she?" Franny asked.
She walked slowly to her father, leaned against him, and he put his arm around her.
"I don't think so."
"Never mind. We won't think about it for now."
"I ought to go. She doesn't want me here."
"You ought to stay. You ought to be here when, if she comes to and finds out she still needs you to stay. He paused. Me? I already do, Fran.
Daddy, she said, and put her head against his chest. Oh, Daddy, I'm so sorry. Just so goddamn sorry.
Shh, he said, and stroked her hair. Over her head, he could see the afternoon sunlight streaming duskily in through the bow windows, as it had always done, golden and still, the way sunlight falls into museums and the halls of the dead. Shh, Franny. I love you. I love you. Chapter 13. The red light went on. The pump hissed. The door opened. The man who stepped through was not wearing one of the white all-over suits, but a small shiny nose filter that looked a little bit like a two-pronged silver fork, the kind the hostess leaves on the canopy table to get the olives out of the bottle. "Hi, Mr. Redman," he said, strolling across the room. He stuck out his hand, clad in a thin transparent rubber glove, and Stu, surprised into the defensive, shook it. "I'm Dick Dietz. Denninger said you wouldn't play ball anymore unless somebody told you what the score was." Stu nodded. "Good." Dietz sat on the edge of the bed. He was a small brown man, and sitting there with his elbows cocked just above his knees, he looked like a gnome in a Disney picture. "So what do you want to know?" "First, I guess I want to know why you're not wearing one of those spacesuits." "Because Geraldo there says you're not catching it." Dietz pointed to a guinea pig behind the double-paned window. The guinea pig was in a cage, and standing behind the cage was Denninger himself, his face expressionless.
"Geraldo, huh?"
"Geraldo's been breathing your air for the last 3 days via convector. This disease that your friends have passes easily from humans to guinea pigs and vice versa. If you were catching, we figure Geraldo would be dead by now."
"But you're not taking any chances," Stu said dryly, and cocked a thumb at the nose filter.
"That," Dietz said with a cynical smile, "is not in my contract."
"What have I got?"
Smoothly, as if rehearsed, Dietz said, "Black hair, blue eyes, one hell of a suntan." He looked closely at Stu. "Not funny, huh?" Stu said nothing. "Want to hit me?"
"I don't believe it would do any good."
Dietz sighed and rubbed the bridge of his nose as if the plugs going up the nostrils hurt. "Listen," he said. "When things look serious, I do jokes. Some people smoke or chew gum. It's the way I keep my shit together, that's all. I don't doubt there are lots of people who have better ways. As to what sort of disease you've got, well, so far as Denninger and his colleagues have been able to ascertain, you don't have any at all." Stu nodded impassively, yet somehow he had an idea this little gnome of a man had seen past his poker face to his sudden and deep relief.
"What have the others got?"
"I'm sorry, that's classified."
"How did that fellow Campion get it?"
"That's classified, too."
"My guess is that he was in the army, and there was an accident someplace, like what happened to those sheep in Utah 30 years ago, only a lot worse."
"Mr. Redman, I could go to jail just for telling you you were hot or cold." Stu rubbed a hand thoughtfully over his new scrub of beard. "You should be glad we're not telling you any more than we are," Dietz said. "You know that, don't you?"
"So I can serve my country better," Stu said dryly.
"No, that's strictly Denninger's thing," Dietz said. "In the scheme of things, both Denninger and I are little men, but Denninger is even littler than I am. He's a servo motor, nothing more. There's a more pragmatic reason for you to be glad. You're classified too, you know. You've disappeared from the face of the earth. If you knew enough, the big guys might decide that the safest thing would be for you to disappear forever." Stu said nothing. He was stunned. "But I didn't come here to threaten you. We want your cooperation very badly, Mr. Redman. We need it."
"Where are the other people I came in here with?"
Dietz brought a paper out of an inside pocket. "Victor Palfrey, deceased. Norman Bruett, Robert Bruett, deceased. Thomas Wanamaker, deceased. Ralph Hodges, Bert Hodges, Cheryl Hodges, deceased. Christian Ortega, deceased. Anthony Leominster, deceased. The names reeled in Stu's head. Chris the bartender. He'd always kept a sawed-off, lead-loaded Louisville slugger under the bar, and the trucker who thought Chris was just kidding about using it was apt to get a big surprise. Tony Leominster, who drove that big international with the Cobra CB under the dash. Sometimes hung around Hap Station, but hadn't been there the night Campion took out the pumps. Vic Palfrey. Christ, he had known Vic his whole life. How could Vic be dead? But the thing that hit him the hardest was the Hodges family. All of them? He heard himself ask. Ralph's whole family? Dietz turned the paper over. No, there's a little girl, Eva, 4 years old. She's alive. Well, how is she? I'm sorry, that's classified. Rage struck him with all the unexpectedness of a sweet surprise. He was up, and then he had hold of Dietz's lapels, and he was shaking him back and forth. From the corner of his eye, he saw startled movement behind the double-paned glass. Dimly, muffled by distance and soundproofed walls, he heard a hooter go off. "What did you people do?" he shouted. "What did you do? What in Christ's name did you do?" "Mr. Redmond, huh? What the fuck did you people do?" The door hissed open. Three large men in olive-drab uniforms stepped in. They were all wearing nose filters. Dietz looked over at them and snapped, "Get the hell out of here!" The three men looked uncertain. "Our orders! Get out of here, and that's an order!" They retreated. Dietz sat calmly on the bed. His lapels were rumpled, and his hair had tumbled over his forehead. That was all. He was looking at Stu calmly, even compassionately. For a wild moment, Stu considered ripping his nose filter out, and then he remembered Geraldo. What a stupid name for a guinea pig. Dull despair struck him like cold water. He sat down. "Christ in a sidecar," he muttered. "Listen to me," Dietz said. "I'm not responsible for you being here. Neither is Denninger or the nurses who come in to take your blood pressure. If there was a responsible party, it was Campion, but you can't lay it all on him either. He ran, but under the circumstances, you or I might have run too. It was a technical slip-up that allowed him to run. The situation exists. We are trying to cope with it, all of us. But that doesn't make us responsible." "Then who is?" "Nobody," Dietz said, and smiled. "On this one, the responsibility spreads in so many directions that it's invisible. It was an accident. It could have happened in any number of other ways."
"Some accident," Stu said, his voice nearly a whisper.
"What about the others? Hap and Hank Carmichael and Lila Bruett? Their boy Luke? Monty Sullivan?" "Classified," Dietz said. "Going to shake me some more? If it'll make you feel better, shake away." Stu said nothing, but the way he was looking at Dietz made Dietz suddenly look down and begin to fiddle with the creases of his pants. "They're alive," he said, "and you may see them in time."
"What about Arnett?"
"Quarantined."
"Who's dead there?"
"Nobody."
"You're lying."
"Sorry you think so."
"When do I get out of here?"
"I don't know."
"Classified?" Stu asked bitterly.
"No, just unknown. You don't seem to have this disease. We want to know why you don't have it. Then we're home free."
"Can I get a shave? I itch."
Dietz smiled. "If you'll allow Denninger to start running his tests again, I'll get an orderly in to shave you right now."
"I can handle it. I've been doing it since I was 15.
Dietz shook his head firmly. "I think not." Stu smiled dryly at him.
"Afraid I might cut my own throat?"
"Let's just say..."
Stu interrupted him with a series of harsh, dry coughs. He bent over with the force of them.
The effect on Dietz was galvanic. He was up off the bed like a shot and across to the airlock with his feet seeming not to touch the floor at all. Then he was fumbling in his pocket for the square key and ramming it into the slot.
"Don't bother," Stu said mildly. "I was faking."
Dietz turned to him slowly. Now his face had changed. His lips were thinned with anger, his eyes staring.
"You were what?"
"Faken," Stu said. His smile broadened. Dietz took two uncertain steps toward him. His fists closed, opened, then closed again.
"But why? Why would you want to do something like that?"
"Sorry," Stu said, smiling. "That's classified."
"You shit son of a bitch," Dietz said with soft wonder.
Go on out and tell them they can do their tests." He slept better that night than he had since they had brought him here, and he had an extremely vivid dream. He had always dreamed a great deal. His wife had complained about him thrashing and muttering in his sleep, but he had never had a dream like this. He was standing on a country road at the precise place where the black hot top gave up to bone-white dirt. A blazing summer sun shone down. On both sides of the road there was green corn, and it stretched away endlessly. There was a sign, but it was dusty, and he couldn't read it. There was the sound of crows, harsh and far away. Closer by, someone was playing an acoustic guitar, finger-picking it. Vic Palfrey had been a picker, and it was a fine sound. "This is where I ought to get to," Stu thought dimly. "Yeah, this is the place, all right." What was that tune? "Beautiful Zion? The Fields of My Father's Home? Sweet By and By?" Some hymn he remembered from his childhood, something he associated with full immersion and picnic lunches, but he couldn't remember which one. Then the music stopped. A cloud came over the sun. He began to be afraid. He began to feel that there was something terrible, something worse than plague, fire, or earthquake. Something was in the corn, and it was watching him. Something dark was in the corn. He looked and saw two burning red eyes far back in the shadows, far back in the corn. Those eyes filled him with the paralyzed, hopeless horror that the hen feels for the weasel. "Him," he thought. The man with no face. Oh, dear God. Oh, dear God, no. Then the dream was fading, and he awoke with feelings of disquiet, dislocation, and relief. He went to the bathroom and then to his window. He looked out at the moon. He went back to bed, but it was an hour before he got back to sleep. All that corn, he thought sleepily. Must have been Iowa or Nebraska, maybe northern Kansas. But he had never been in any of those places in his life. Chapter 14. It was 11:45. Outside the small pillbox window, dark pressed evenly against the glass. Dietz sat alone in the office cubicle, tie pulled down, collar button undone. His feet were up on the anonymous metal desk, and he was holding a microphone. On top of the desk, the reels of an old-fashioned Wallensack tape recorder turned and turned. "This is Colonel Dietz," he said. "Located Atlanta Facility Code PB2. This is Report 16, Subject File Project Blue, Subfile Princess Prince. This report file and subfile are top secret, classification 223, eyes only. If you are not classified to receive this material, fuck off, Jack." He stopped and let his eyes fall closed for a moment. The tape reels ran on smoothly, undergoing all the correct electrical and magnetic changes. "Prince gave me one hell of a scare tonight," he said at last. "I won't go into it. It'll be in Deniger's report. That guy will be more than willing to quote chapter and verse. Plus, of course, a transcription of my conversation with Prince will be on the telecommunications disc, which also contains the transcription of this tape, which is being made at 23:45 hours. I was almost pissed enough to hit him because he scared the living Jesus out of me. I am not pissed any more, however. The man put me into his shoes, and for just a second there I knew exactly how it feels to shake in them. He's a fairly bright man once you get past the Gary Cooper exterior, and one independent son of a bitch. If it suits him, he'll find all sorts of novel monkey wrenches to throw into the gears. He has no close family in Arnett or any place else, so we can't put much of a hammerlock on him. Denninger has volunteers, or says he does, who'll be happy to go in and muscle him into a more cooperative frame of mind. And it may come to that, but if I may be pardoned another personal observation, I believe it would take more muscle than Denninger thinks. Maybe a whole lot more. For the record, I am still against it. My mother used to say you can catch more flies with honey than you can with vinegar, and I guess I still believe it. Again, for the record, he still tests virus clean. You figure it out. He paused again, fighting the urge to doze off. He had managed only 4 hours of sleep in the last 72. Record says of 2,200 hours, he said formally, and picked a sheaf of reports off the desk. Henry Carmichael died while I was talking with Prince. The cop, Joseph Robert Brentwood, died half an hour ago. This won't be in Dr. D's report, but he was all but shitting green apples over that one. Brentwood showed a sudden positive response to the vaccine type. He shuffled papers. Here it is, 63A3. See subfile if you like. Brentwood's fever broke. The characteristic swellings in the glands of the neck went down. He reported hunger and ate a poached egg and a slice of unbuttered toast. Spoke rationally, wanted to know where he was, and so on and so on and scooby-dooby-doo. Then around 2,000 hours, the fever came back with a bang. Delirious. He broke the restraints on his bed and went reeling around the room, yelling, coughing, blowing snot. The whole bit. Then he fell over and died. Kaboom. The opinion of the team is that the vaccine killed him. It made him better for a while, but he was getting sick again even before it killed him. So it's back to the old drawing boards. He paused. I saved the worst for last. We can declassify Princess back to plain old Eva Hodges, female, age 4, Caucasian. Her coach and 4 turned back into a pumpkin and a bunch of mice late this afternoon. To look at her, you'd think she was perfectly normal, not even a sniffle. She's downhearted, of course. She misses her mom. Other than that, she appears perfectly normal. She's got it, though. Her post-lunch BP first showed a drop, then a rise, which is the only halfway decent diagnostic tool Denninger's got so far. Before supper, Denninger showed me her sputum slides. As an incentive to diet, sputum slides are really primo, believe me. And they're lousy with those wagon-wheel germs he says aren't really germs at all, but incubators. I can't understand how he can know where this thing is and what it looks like and still not be able to stop it. He gives me a lot of jargon, but I don't think he understands it either. Dietz lit a cigarette. So where are we tonight? We've got a disease that's got several well-defined stages, but some people may skip a stage. Some people may backtrack a stage. Some people may do both. Some people stay in one stage for a relatively long time, and others zoom through all 4 as if they were on a rocket sled. One of our 2 clean subjects is no longer clean. The other is a 30-year-old redneck who seems to be as healthy as I am. Denninger has done about 30 million tests on him and has succeeded in isolating only 4 abnormalities. Redman appears to have a great many moles on his body. He has a slight hypertensive condition, too slight to medicate right now. He develops a mild tic under his left eye when he's under stress, and Denninger says he dreams a great deal more than average, almost all night, every night. They got that from the standard EEG series they ran before he went on strike. And that's it. I can't make anything out of it, neither can Dr. Denninger, and neither can the people who check Dr. Demento's work. This scares me, Starkey. It scares me because nobody but a very smart doctor with all the facts is going to be able to diagnose anything but a common cold in the people who are out there carrying this. Christ, nobody goes to the doctor anymore unless they've got pneumonia, or a suspicious lump on the tit, or a bad case of the dancing hives. Too hard to get one to look at you. So they're going to stay home, drink fluids, and get plenty of bed rest, and then they're going to die. Before they do, they're going to infect everyone who comes into the same room with them. All of us are still expecting the prince. I think I used his real name here someplace, but at this juncture I don't really give a fuck. To come down with it tonight or tomorrow or the day after, at the latest. And so far, no one who's come down with it has gotten better. Those sons of bitches out in California did this job a little too well for my taste.
Dietz, Atlanta PB Facility 2. This report ends. He turned off the recorder and stared at it for a long time. Then he lit another cigarette. Chapter 15. It was 2 minutes to midnight. Patty Greer, the nurse who had been trying to take Stu's blood pressure when he went on strike, was leafing through the current issue of McCall's at the nurse's station and waiting to go in and check Mr. Sullivan and Mr. Hapscom. Hap would still be awake watching Johnny Carson and would be no problem. He liked to josh her about how hard it would be to pinch her bottom through her white all-over suit. Mr. Hapscom was scared, but he was being cooperative, not like that dreadful Stuart Redman, who only looked at you and wouldn't say boo to a goose. Mr. Hapscom was what Patty Greer thought of as a good sport. As far as she was concerned, all patients could be divided into two categories: good sports and old poops. Patty, who had broken a leg roller skating when she was 7 and had never spent a day in bed since, had very little patience with the old poops. You were either really sick and being a good sport, or you were a hypochondriac old poop making trouble for a poor working girl. Mr. Sullivan would be asleep, and he would wake up ugly. It wasn't her fault that she had to wake him up, and she would think Mr. Sullivan would understand that. He should just be grateful that he was getting the best care the government could provide, and all free at that. And she would just tell him so if he started being an old poop again tonight. The clock touched midnight. Time to get going. She left the nurse's station and walked down the hallway toward the white room, where she would first be sprayed and then helped into her suit. Halfway there, her nose began to tickle. She got her hanky out of her pocket and sneezed lightly 3 times. She replaced the handkerchief. Intent on dealing with cranky Mr. Sullivan, she attached no significance to her sneezes. It was probably a touch of hay fever. The directive in the nurse's station, which said in big red letters, "Report any cold symptoms, no matter how minor, to your supervisor at once," never even crossed her mind. They were worried that whatever those poor people from Texas had might spread outside the sealed rooms, but she also knew it was impossible for even a tiny virus to get inside the self-contained environment of the white suits. Nevertheless, on her way down to the white room, she infected an orderly, a doctor who was just getting ready to leave, and another nurse on her way to do her midnight rounds. A new day had begun. Chapter 16. A day later, on June 23rd, a big white Connie was roaring north on US 180 in another part of the country. It was doing somewhere between 90 and 100, its Corinthian white paint job glittering in the sun, the chrome winking. The opera windows in the rear also gave back the sun, heliographing it viciously. The trail that Connie had left behind itself since Polk and Lloyd killed its owner and stole it somewhere just south of Hachita was wandering and pretty much senseless. Up 81 to US 80, the turnpike, until Polk and Lloyd began to feel nervous. They had killed 6 people in the last 6 days, including the owner of the Continental, his wife, and his smarmy daughter. But it was not the 6 murders that made them feel antsy about being on the interstate. It was the dope and the guns. 5 grams of hash, a little tin snuff box filled with God knew how much coke, and 16 pounds of marijuana. Also, 2.38s, 3.45s, a 357 mag that Polk called his pokerizer, 6 shotguns, 2 of them sawed-off pumps, and a Schmeisser submachine gun. Murder was a trifle beyond their intellectual reach, but they both understood the trouble they were going to be in if the Arizona State Police picked them up in a stolen car full of blow and shooting irons. On top of everything else, they were interstate fugitives, had been ever since they crossed the Nevada border. Interstate fugitives. Lloyd Henreid liked the sound of that. Gangbusters. Take that, you dirty rat. Have a lead sandwich, you lousy copper. So they had turned north at Deming, now on 180, had gone through Hurley and Bayard and the slightly larger town of Silver City, where Lloyd had bought a bag of burgers and 8 milkshakes. Why in the name of Christ had he bought 8 of the motherfuckers? They would soon be pissing chocolate.
grinning at the waitress in an empty yet hilarious way that made her nervous for hours afterward. "I believe that man would just as soon killed me as looked at me," she told her boss that afternoon. Past Silver City and roaring through Cliff, the road now bending west again, just the direction they didn't want to go. Through Buckhorn, and then they were back in the country God forgot, two-lane blacktop running through sagebrush and sand, buttes and mesas in the background. All that same old made you want to just rear back and puke at it.
"We're getting low on gas," Polk said.
"Wouldn't be if you didn't drive so fucking fast," Lloyd said. He took a sip of his third milkshake, gagged on it, powered down the window, and threw out all the leftover crap, including the three milkshakes neither of them had touched.
"Whoop! Whoop!" Polk cried.
He began to goose the gas pedal. The Connie lurched forward, dropped back, lurched forward.
"Ride 'em, cowboy," Lloyd yelled.
"Whoop! Whoop!"
"You want to smoke?"
"Smoke 'em if you got 'em," Polk said.
"Whoop! Whoop!"
There was a large green hefty bag on the floor between Lloyd's feet. It held the 16 pounds of marijuana. He reached in, got a handful, and began to roll a bomber joint.
"Whoop! Whoop!"
The Connie cruised back and forth over the white line.
"Cut the shit," Lloyd shouted. "I'm spilling it everywhere."
"Plenty more where that came from. Whoop!"
"Come on, we gotta deal this stuff, man. We gotta deal this stuff or we're gonna get caught and wind up in somebody's trunk."
"Okay, sport."
Polk began to drive smoothly again, but his expression was sulky.
"It was your idea, your fucking idea."
"You thought it was a good idea."
"Yeah, but I didn't know we'd end up driving all over fucking Arizona.
How are we ever going to get to New York this way?"
"We're throwing off pursuit, man," Lloyd said.
In his mind, he saw police garage doors opening and thousands of 1940s radio cars issuing forth into the night. Spotlights crawling over brick walls.
"Come on out, Canarsie. We know you're in there."
"Good fucking luck," Polk said, still sulking. "We're doing a hell of a job. You know what we got besides that dope and the guns? We got 16 bucks and 300 fucking credit cards we don't dare use. What the fuck? We don't even have enough cash to fill this hog's gas tank."
"God will provide," Lloyd said, and spit-sealed the bomber. He lit it with the Connie's dashboard lighter.
"Happy fucking days." "And if you want to sell it, what are we doing smoking it?" Polk went on, not much mollified by the thought of God providing.
"So we sell a few short ounces. Come on, Polk, have a smoke."
This never failed to break Polk up. He brayed laughter and took the joint. Between them, standing on its wire stock, was the Schmeisser, fully loaded. The Connie blazed on up the road, its gas gauge standing at an eighth. Polk and Lloyd had met a year before in the Brownsville Minimum Security Station, a Nevada work farm. Brownsville was 90 acres of irrigated farmland and a prison compound of Quonset huts, about 60 miles north of Tonopah and 80 northeast of Gabs. It was a mean place to do short time. Although Brownsville Station was supposed to be a farm, nothing much grew there. Carrots and lettuce got one taste of that blaring sun, chuckled weakly, and died. Legumes and weeds would grow, and the state legislature was fanatically dedicated to the idea that someday soybeans would grow. But the kindest thing that could be said about Brownsville's ostensible purpose was that the desert was taking a Christless long time to bloom. The warden, who preferred to be called the boss, prided himself on being a hard-ass, and he hired only men he considered to be fellow hard-asses. And, as he was fond of telling the new fish, Brownsville was mostly minimum security because when it came to escape, it was like the song said, "No place to run to, baby, no place to hide." Some gave it a shot anyway, but most were brought back in 2 or 3 days, sunburned, glare-blind, and eager to sell the boss their shriveled raisin souls for a drink of water. Some of them cackled madly, and one young man who was out for 3 days claimed he saw a large castle some miles south of Gabs, a castle with a moat. The moat, he said, was guarded by trolls riding big black horses. Some months later, when a Colorado revival preacher did a show at Brownsville, this same young man got Jesus in a big way. Andrew Polk Freeman, in for simple assault, was released in April 1989. He had occupied